Where can you find Adam Carolla, Dr. Drew, Jay Moore, Tom Green, Dennis Miller, Ron Paul, Laura Ingraham, Penn Jillette, and Maria Menounos hanging out together? At PodcastOne.com, that's where. Woo-hoo! Podcasts are like the best radio shows you've ever heard, only they're on demand, uncensored, and with you wherever you go, on your tablet, your computer, even your smartphone. And PodcastOne.com is the place to discover all the best podcasts for free. There's comedy, entertainment, politics, and more. PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to my podcast. This is Paul Mercurio. We put together a bonus episode, a compilation of some interviews that we thought were really fun and cool that we wanted people to hear. This podcast has two parts. The first part is with Norm Pattiz, the founder of Westwood One Radio, the biggest radio network in the world. He also founded Podcast One, which aggregates hundreds of podcasts in one location. A really cool guy, amazing background, served under two presidents, founded radio in the Middle East, huge Lakers fan, sits courtside every game. Just a really, really interesting interview that we wanted people to hear. And the second part is with the host of Mythbusters, Adam Savage, Jamie Hyneman. Loved the show. Was really excited and honored that they were part of the podcast. Some amazing background on these guys that you'll learn in listening to this and how they got to where they are. So we're really excited about these and wanted you guys to hear them. And if you want to hear full episodes of these podcasts, you can go to Podcast One or the Sideshow Network. And we also have other really cool interviews that I did with Lewis Black, the executive producer of The Daily Show, Rory Albanese, and Bob Costas. An amazing interview with Bob. We're really excited about them, so check them out. And if you want to see me doing stand-up this week, I'll be in New York City at the Comedy Cellar, the Comic Strip Comedy Club, and Stand Up New York Comedy Club. And you can follow me online on Twitter. I'm at Paul Mercurio, on Facebook, Paul Mercurio, and on my website, paulmercurio.com. All right, enjoy the podcast.
You were right when you said I didn't get into this business or even the radio business early on because of the money. I got in the business because I was attracted to show business. I mean, I was born in Southern California. I'm right. A native,
right.
One of the few. You don't find many people who've been around here as long as I have. And my first job in the entertainment business was in the mailroom at a talent agency called GAC, which has since morphed into several other incarnations.
What is that experience like in a mailroom? I hear all the time, even to this day, I work in the mailroom.
Right.
Does it make a difference? Do you learn? Is it a place? Is it a jumping off point for
well, bigger, sure. Better things? You learn how to get out of it. That's the point of getting into the mailroom is you've got people who are motivated to go further yeah. in the business and are willing to work for practically nothing, delivering mail to figure out where their next step's going to be.
What are you learning when you're delivering that mail?
Who the agents are and what it is that they do, who the clients are, where they live, what you got to deliver to these places. It's like when I go out and make speeches at colleges, which I like to do because of my involvement with education and my involvement with the business. And they say to me, well, you know, how do you learn? And, you know, give me some textbooks. And I tell them that the textbooks are the trades, you know, yeah. It's the trade publications,
right.
You know, whether they're what they used to be, you know, actual publications that, you know, people picked up and opened and they had pages and you read them or they're online.
Right.
Because that's really where you go to educate you on the business that you want to be in or the variety of businesses right. that you want to be in. When I thought about getting into the entertainment business, I didn't know where I wanted to go.
Well, you were working as a karate instructor, a bouncer. What were some of the jobs that you had before? Because this is what's fascinating. Here is a man who's been appointed by two presidents, serves on as chairman of two nuclear laboratories, has amazing involvement in the Middle East in establishing radio in 22 countries, and just give people a flavor of where you started, because this is a main reason I do this podcast. I want people to understand when you meet great people who've achieved amazing things, you have no idea where you're going to end up based on where you start.
Well, I started as a middle-class kid in West Los Angeles, you know, who went to a a pretty good high school because I transferred out of the district that I was in. I remember my father going down to the Board of Education and saying he was the original sit-in. He told him he was going to sit on the counter of that office until his son got a transfer to go to this other school.
That's great.
And he got it. And, you know, I went to school. I was an unremarkable student. And I went to junior college where I was an unremarkable student. I was and then I always had sort of this desire to be a you know, to find something to do in the entertainment business, because at that time and even today, Los Angeles to a large degree is a company town for the entertainment business.
Absolutely.
All the studios were here, second largest radio market. You know, the first you know, live television broadcast to the West Coast was done here. You know, steeped in history, and I'm old enough to remember a lot of that stuff. I mean, I remember radio before television, when radio was the it was a medium of programs. You know, then television comes; it becomes the medium of programs, and radio has to adapt radically so that it becomes a medium of formats.
How explain what that means to people? So, how did it adapt, and what is a radio a form of formats? How, explain what that means to people.
Well, a medium of programs is understandable. It's what television is today. People go to their favorite programs. They don't have a particular loyalty to a channel.
Yes,
wherever their program is, that's where they go.
Right.
Radio became something completely different. It became a vertical format that played music, did talk radio, had news, had religious programming. But every radio station did the same thing from sign-on to sign-off. They if it was a music-formatted station, if it was a top 40 station, all they played was top 40 music. If it was a rock and roll station, that's all they played. If it was a Spanish language station, maybe they were doing news and talk, or maybe they were doing Spanish language music. But when you went into somebody's car and you took a look at the settings on their radio, you knew something about who owned that car, because people didn't move from station from program to program; they went to their favorite station.
And then I got you.
You know, so even today, I mean. Here in Los Angeles, if you want to hear popular music, you're probably going to listen to Kiss FM.
Right.
And if you want to hear alternative music, you'll probably go to K-Rock. And they have the same in every market, especially the major markets, it's pretty much the same thing.
Right.
So there really wasn't much in the way of programming that separated radio stations of similar formats, because they were all playing the same music.
Got it.
And one of the things we did at Westwood One is we started creating special events, weekly programs, little features that gave stations the opportunity to differentiate themselves from the guy across the street who was playing the same music.
Up until 2011, I believe Westwood One was broadcasting or at least recording live concerts, right? And distributing and marketing and syndicating those.
Yeah, it's one of the first things that we did to differentiate ourselves. There was another company that was there first, okay? A company called DIR, doing the King Biscuit Flower Hour.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? They were first. We weren't the first mover. But, you know, they were small. We were small, too. But we saw a way to go in and kind of corner that market. And, you know, we established relationships with record companies and artists. Instead of going out and renting mobile recording equipment, we built our own state-of-the-art mobile recording studio, put the best engineers in there. Artists wanted to work with those engineers. And then we started packaging it with the variety of other programs that we were selling to advertisers and offering it to radio stations. So we began the process of aggregating content. And then as we got larger and larger, we started buying other companies that were in that business.
And Westwood owned the content.
Yeah, it was all our own content. We weren't a rep.
We
produced and distributed our own stuff.
And you start to sort of look at the landscape nationally and start to say, okay, in Milwaukee, these people, these listeners are going for this kind of thing. And you literally would, you would sort of have an inventory of content where you could sort of target any part of the country and feed that need.
Sure, and local radio was a giant laboratory for us.
Meaning?
Oh, you got all these local radio stations, thousands and thousands of local radio stations that are doing things. They're not all owned by single companies then. Back then, no single company could own more than five AMs or five FMs. I'm not talking about in a city. I'm talking about in the country.
Wow.
So there were no 400-pound gorillas. And also, owners were required by the FCC in order to get a license to hold their radio station for at least 3 years. So before they could sell it.
They don't want people flipping, doing M&A deals and flipping and trying to make
Which is what radio's turned into.
Right.
So that radio stations are now commodities that are traded and sold and bought,
right.
You know.
So you've got a couple of stations. You got a station in Columbus, Ohio. And you now, so that so that station, for example, is a laboratory for you at Westwood One in what sense?
Well, we take a look at the – if something stands out, like for instance, I'll give you an example of a program that we loved that was not successful, okay? But we loved it. Mm. There was a station – God, it was in the Midwest. It was Flint, Michigan. Flint, Michigan. It was a program on a station in Flint, Michigan. It was called Buffalo Dick's Radio Ranch. And it won the Medium-Sized Market Comedy Program of the Year Award for Billboard Magazine.
Oh, wow.
And somebody sent me an air check. And we sat around in our office and we listened to the show and we were on the floor. We thought it was so funny. It was this the talent whose name escapes me, other than Buffalo Dick.
How can you forget that?
He did a million voices, and he had a sidekick, and he would bring in a dozen kids for every show, which was kind of his peanut gallery, like the old Howdy Doody television show. So he's performing in front of a dozen kids, mm-hmm. and he's doing really funny things like giving traffic reports from the Buffalo Dick Chopper. And I thought this was just funnier than shit.
Yeah.
So without doing any research, you know, because at that time we didn't do a lot of research, you know, it was just kind of feel.
Talk about that for a minute, because you hear a lot about that and you talk about people, you know, veterans in television too, in terms of the way they program now. And I've certainly experienced it as talent. I've shot some pilots and it looks great, and then it gets stuck in a room with a bunch of people who they pay $50 a head to because they got nothing to do that day, and then suddenly the outcome is different. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is there too much research? People meters now apparently are dictating things, but if I have a people meter on and I for radio and I walk into my dentist's office and I'm sitting there for 2 hours, it reads that I'm listening to jazz when I wasn't. So is the tail wagging the dog with research? Are you losing great people like yourself who have good instincts and they're not allowed to exercise them?
No, I research doesn't scare me, mm-hmm. Because it's your ability to adapt to the research and use the information to determine how you're going to do what you do.
But if your instinct is like, hey, you know, great guys, you brought me all these great numbers, right? Edison, great research company
right.
that you're working with now with
Correct.
Podcast, right?
Correct.
And you're like, you know what? I'm Norman. I've been doing this for 40 years, whatever. And I'm just telling you, I know the numbers say this, but my gut says that direction.
Well,
what do you do then?
You find a way to validate your gut. Okay, which is you find other ways to market your program. If the research, which is getting more and more granular every day, too granular in the sense that sometimes, you know, I don't want to know all of the information that they're giving me because it reduces the size of my audience by so much that it becomes, you know, may not become saleable. But you find other ways to sell it. For instance, in a podcast,
mm-hmm.
We have a lot of podcasts that reach very large audiences.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of podcasts that reach small targeted audiences.
Mm-hmm.
But if the small targeted program have P1s, which in the music business is your most active listener. That's the listener at a radio station who's going to call in, make requests, go out and buy the record, going to go to the concert. Those are your real active listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a small percentage of your overall audience. But for a podcast, which requires a positive action to download the program, most of the people who download those programs are P1s. So
right.
You simply go to an advertiser and you say, these are very, very active listeners, these are your customers. You don't have to pay for a huge audience that isn't going to buy your product. You focus in, you may wind up paying a higher cost per thousand, but you're going to get the audience that is going to consume your product. And then you hit them with the coup de grace, which is the host of that program, which is the reason why people are tuning in at the first place, mm-hmm. does the commercial.
Right.
Okay. And if they do the commercial, I mean, there are a lot of people.
Those reads matter.
Those reads are, you know, especially if the host believes in the product.
Yeah.
So one of the things we do, because we don't want a host to go out and not believe in the product.
Right.
We try and find products that the host believes in so that it comes across in the podcast.
Right.
And if it's something that they really believe in and they do the read, and they talk about it within the program,
right.
even if the audience isn't the huge audience.
It's a qualitative.
It's a record. High quality audience.
And the numbers back that up. Edison's done some research, and you're working, Launchpad Media and Podcast One is working with Edison, who's a New Jersey-based media research and survey company. They found 85% of people download and listen to a podcast within 48 hours. In 2012, 29% of Americans were 12 or older who listened to the podcast. It was 23% in 2010 and 13% in 2007. So those numbers are growing. And half those listeners were 12 to 34, which is a prime demographic. And 38% use iPods or some other smartphone to listen in their car. So what that's saying is that they are very active. It's backing up exactly what you're saying, and what I'm fascinated by is a couple
things. And also,
things.
There's tons of headroom. There's plenty of room for growth.
Why and where?
Well, if only 30% of the population is regularly listening to podcasts,
right.
My belief is that it's the 70% of the population, a very large percentage of those people, don't realize that podcasts are either there or the ease at which they can access them.
You know, you got to give props to Discovery for knowing when to get out of the way, too. You know, and a lot of networks know that, you know, so they always got to. And as a show becomes more successful, in my experience, more and more people want to put their fingerprints on it because they want to get a little bit of the credit for it. And then it just starts to muck up the waters, you know, so it's nice. And you mentioned your like, separate life choices. I mean, Jamie, I'm both curious as to if either of you, as kids, saw this life that you have now and the kind of thing you're doing. Because, I mean, Jamie, you were a bit of a rebel as a young kid, like 14. You were hitchhiking around the country. Is that right?
Yeah. I was pretty independent. Truth be told, I never had any inclination to be on camera or do what I never had any idea it was going to turn out the way it was. I mean, here we're, you know, known as the champions of science and mm-hmm. science education and all that kind of stuff. And neither of us have a science degree.
Dude, how at 14 do you go, like you dropped out of school and just started hitchhiking? You're like, you weren't like, that's a pretty big set of balls. Like what was
going to be? It was the 1930s.
Got to tell the story, Adam. It was the 60s, and you know, we lived in my mother. She was a librarian at Indiana University at the graduate library school.
Your mom, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, in the middle of farm country, here's this university, and it was so she was part of this conservative, farm upbringing, but aware of all of the turmoil from the 60s.
Right.
And so they, and for that matter, so was I, and I was into it. So they decided to keep a little too tight of a rein on me, and they wanted to enroll me in a military school.
When you say, I'm sorry, let me interrupt. When you say you were into it, meaning that it resonated with you, the rebellious nature of that time, or you were participating in the rebellion in some way? What do you mean by that?
Well, I had long hair and I was, I guess I was sort of a hippie.
Yeah.
If you can be a hippie at 14.
I think you can.
And so that kind of implies everything that you would think, in that, you know, a hippie is not necessarily like violent or, you know, drug addicted or anything of the sort. It was just, it was a cultural thing at the time.
Right.
And so, they were, determined to make sure that I stayed on course, and they, you know, I was out mowing the lawn, on the weekend, and they said, you're going to go to this school or we're not going to let you get back in the house. And I said, okay. And I left.
Wow.
And, so, and in hindsight, after, you know, I hitchhiked all over the country. I hitchhiked to the university, and I, you know, I hung out with I had a dollar and, you know, I think it was 57 cents in my pocket. Mm. And that was enough for a slice of pizza. And, you know, and I managed to get a place to stay with a guy that was, you know, throwing the pizzas in the pizza place, and, you know, until I could get myself together. And then I hitched to Florida, and I'd work in a dishwasher, or work as a dishwasher in restaurants and sleep on the beach and stuff like that.
I'm surprised you're not dead. Seriously. Like, I, like, you hitched at 14 from the Midwest to Florida and all over the country, that someone didn't pick you up. And I, good for, unbelievable. That's unbelievable.
Well, that's the thing about the 60s, you know, it was,
yeah,
it was the VW buses painted with flowers, yeah, and stuff like that, and everybody smoking pot and in a good mood, and it was all, you know, it was all good. It was one, it was one big party.
Yeah. And, the, and your parents must have been out of their minds. I mean, Adam and I are parents, and Jeremy, you don't have kids, do you? Do you have kids?
No.
But I can imagine my kid's going to be 14 in a couple of years. Your parents must have been out of their minds worried, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. My favorite thing is that after I first heard this story from Jamie, and we didn't – Jamie is not incredibly forthcoming with this kind of stuff. You just kind of got to grab it piecemeal. But he and I and our crew are driving through this, like, endless long straight road into the – you know, into eternity in Texas. And Jamie says to us, well, I once spent, you know, 24 hours on a bump in the road in Texas. And we're like, you've got to explain that. And then he tells us the story about hitchhiking across the country. And when he finally got back home, I said, how did your parents react when you finally got back home? And he said, they never really gave me any trouble after that.
Well,
you missed there's all sorts of good stories there. You missed the thing about the bump in the road in Texas was it was like, it was an exit with a, you know, nothing but a gas station there that was open all night. And it was flat every place to both horizons from that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there. It took me 24 hours or so to get a ride, as I recall. And you'd see a set of headlights pop up over the horizon, and it's like friggin' 10 miles away. Mm-hmm. And it's still like 5 miles away, and you've got your thumb out. And then, you know, and then all in a whoosh, it goes by you, and then you stare at the headlights for the next, you know, 20 miles on the other side. It was bizarre.
Now, at that point,
I was hitchhiking with a guy that I had met in New York City, and we were both on the side of the road there with signs that said L.A. And so we decided to hitchhike together. And I remember just sitting in the middle of this three-line highway or whatever it was, with a golf ball that we had found on the side of the road, just bouncing the golf ball back and forth in the middle of the night and, you know, and into the next day and everything else. So, I hitched all over the place, and I had a great time. The only bad time that I had during that whole experience was when I finally got picked up in Weed, California, because it was like 11:30 at night, and I was headed up to Seattle to go to a rock concert there for some reason. And 11:30 was past curfew for some kid, and they actually, you know, I'd been stopped before, and I just told everybody I was 18, and no, I didn't have any ID. Sorry. And
and everybody bought that, huh? No one said this doesn't. They're just, yeah. I guess it's the 60s, right?
Yeah, yeah. And but not, you know, these guys didn't have anything better to do, and I gave them my real name and what town I was from, so they actually called my parents. Right. And they asked my parents if they had given me permission to be there, and the parents said no. And so they put me in a juvenile detention center, which was very unpleasant. And I had to wait there until the bus ticket came, and I went back home. And
he had to fight his way to become king of the detention center.
I was going to say, did you have to like beat up the biggest, strongest guy there to prove that?
Yeah, he took his eye out with a plastic spoon. It was really
yeah,
that was probably the genesis of his ability to make anything out of anything, right? You probably pulled a couple of bed springs out and fashioned a weapon together or something.
Yeah, no, it was less adventurous than that. It was pretty much just the unpleasantness of it being in a room with a stainless steel toilet with no lid on it and lights that stayed on 24 hours a day and that kind of thing. That at any rate, I went back home, and the way the story ends is that my parents actually didn't give me any trouble from then on, but they, to my mother's credit in particular, what they did was she researched this sort of situation, I guess, and decided that if I was going to be inclined to do this kind of thing, they wanted to know that I could take care of myself. So they said that this upcoming summer, we want to put you through this survival training school in Wyoming. And they said, if you do that and if you survive that, okay, then next time you want to take off, you can take the family car. So that's exactly what I did. And the summer after that one, I did, in fact, take the family car and drove all over the country. But now I'm at that point, I was fully trained to go into the wilderness, and just live. And so I became fond of doing that. And I did that kind of thing for a number of years.
Wait a minute. Hang on a second. You can't go to survival training and say you're a survivalist and then drive around in a car. You've got to get out. The only involvement you can have a car at that point is someone takes you to the middle of nowhere, drops you in the middle of nowhere without a car. You have a car. That means you have money. You're staying. Where were you staying? In a hotel or are you sleeping in the car?
No, the idea was you go up into the mountains and you park the car and you could just go into the wilderness.
Did you really do that though?
Yeah. It's, there's another guy that we know up at Industrial Light and Magic that does that kind of thing as well. It's mostly an exercise in fasting.
Our friend Michael goes, yeah, it's mostly an exercise in fasting, but I catch the odd fish.
And that's pretty much it, except that with proper training and everything, you learn the local, and I would do this. I would study before I would go into a place what kind of literature I could get on edible, plant life, mm-hmm. because it takes a lot of work generally to catch animals and things like that.
I don't know, man, though. You had a car. At some point, you just go, screw it, and you go walk back to the car and drive to McDonald's. That's what I would have done.
Well, it's nice to have that option, but it's also really kind of, I don't know, it's liberating to be able to just disappear into some place with only what you can carry on you and live.
Absolutely. I mean, I got to tell you, it sounds like your mother is probably the coolest person on the planet, and that was a very heady way to deal with a kid that was not afraid to play chicken and say, okay, I'm gonna walk out. I mean, it kind of circles back to the idea that the notion that I had, which I was curious about, is, I'm fascinated by people's history because I think it, even in an indirect way, informs who they are and what they are obviously today. And I would imagine the fact, when I heard that you went to survival school and then went out and actually practiced it, that sort of had to be, and if I'm wrong, you tell me, sort of laid the groundwork in some ways for what you do, because you are about a guy that sort of thinks with your head and acts with your hands and can fashion anything together. And I would imagine, would you say that survival school experience was the sort of the tipping point or the beginning of you sort of going down the path that you went with special effects and ultimately where you are today?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the thing was that I understood that, you know, I could pretty much do anything that I wanted to if I set my mind to it.
Mm.
And you know, so I would exercise that ability. And, you know, I've tried, you know, if you look at my resume, I've tried a lot of different things. And I've always managed to come out all the better for it. And every new thing that you try, you have another tool in your toolkit. And at a certain point, you know, I had enough of a foundation that I was able to look at my life and look at who I was and what I wanted to do. And so I focused on effects because it's very creative. It's very hands-on. It's you know, it's not so much of a routine. It's always different. And I had learned to, you know, focus in on what I would enjoy. And so then I pretty much stayed at something related to that for the, you know, and that's been, you know, some over 30, you know, 40 years of doing something like, actually, well, in effects, it's been 40 or 30 some years. So.
How did you, by the way, you've been in a really interesting, and so is Adam, and I want to talk to Adam in a second too about his background, but the certified dive master, wilderness survival expert, boat captain, linguist, pet shop owner. My two favorite are animal wrangler and concrete inspector. Were you really a concrete inspector?
Yeah, I have a cousin who ran a concrete business, concrete inspection business. You know, whenever any kind of a building is, especially a commercial building, is built, they take samples of the concrete, and then, you know, it gets taken to a lab and aged and tested. And so somebody has to go out and do that. And I would go out to building sites and collect the concrete as it was being poured, make the sample, inspect what they were doing with the metal reinforcement and things like that. And so I worked with him for a summer doing that. I was trained to do that.
Oh, cool.
and did that.
Could you be bought?
Could I be bought? Well,
there you go. That's the answer.